I hope you will thank Hector for leading our singing today. He works very hard when it comes his turn to lead the singing in selecting songs that are appropriate. And that last song brought back memories of a man who was the leader of this church when I first came, Ormond Farley. That was Ormond Farley's favorite song, the one that we just sang. Thank you for leading it. I hope my message today is not misunderstood. But there are some things that have been happening in our society the last decade or so that have bothered me to the point that I feel the need to address them to some degree, because they are not Christian in nature. And while we proclaim to be a Christian nation, the more things that are non-Christian creep into our society, the less of a Christian nation we will be. One of these things that bothers me greatly deals with speech. And the kind of speech that is being used by our leaders of our nation. No political party has a monopoly on this, but the vulgarity and the vulgar words that are used really bothers me. I do not remember growing up hearing any congressman or senator or presidential candidate use vulgar words. That was just something that they did not do. And while I realize that by the time those emails are shown to us on the news have abbreviated them with simply the first letter. But it bothers me that they are expressing their ideas in language that I was taught never to use, and I've never used it. I'm reminded of this verse in the book of Colossians, in the fourth chapter of Colossians. Verse 5 says, "Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone." Our conversation, the words that we use, whether we speak them or write them, should always be full of grace. And I think the lack of such conversation and the substitution for that graciousness bothers me a great deal. I've always felt that an educated person, whether educated formally, as evidenced by degrees, or simply educated informally, one sign of it is that we are able to speak our ideas and address our thoughts in language that's pleasing and not insulting or vulgar. So that's one of the things I wanted to say. Perhaps more, another thing that is bothering me a great deal is the sense that getting even and retaliation and vengeance is a Christian response. That, my friends, is absolutely not true. The Bible says, do not avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. I'd like to read a portion from the book of Romans, chapter 12. It says, live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave it room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge, I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Trying to get even seems to be very much a part of the political life, and always the thought is, well, those in power now will get even, but there'll be a change in power, and then that group will want to get even. And it's a vicious, vicious cycle. I've been reading the book of Esther this week. I've read it several times. And I think of the story of Esther involving ancient Persian Empire, which corresponds to our Iran. Although if you look at it, the Persian Empire was quite a bit more extensive than Iran is. It included Iraq and Turkey and many other places in the Far East. But it struck me how that we are still involved in the same kind of hatreds and desire for revenge in that part of the world as they were thousands of years ago. I mean, why can't that be solved? I don't understand that. The book of Esther is about one man's sense of revenge and his desire to avenge what he considered to be personal insults by a Jew named Mordecai. I'm reading the book of Esther, I'm reminded that it is the book most often used to illustrate something we spoke on a few weeks ago, the providence of God. And yet the interesting thing about the book of Esther is that there is no mention of God in the book of Esther. There is no prophet that comes along to teach them. It is all a book written in a story fashion that would be just what anybody would think or do in similar circumstances, whether there was a God or not. But as we look through the book and from the first to the end of it, we know that there is no greater story to illustrate God's providence. King of Persia held a great feast for all his governors and others throughout his kingdom who were important. That feast went on for days, and they imbibed very heavily of wine, and the king became very drunk. when he got drunk, he decided that his governors would like to see displayed the beauty of Vashti, who was the queen. And so he commanded that she perform in front of all these drunken people, and she refused. And that put the king in great distress, because if Vashti can refuse the king, then other wives and women might begin to refuse to do whatever their husbands or men required. And so Vashti was banished and punished by the king for refusal to perform in front of the drunken feast. There was a Jew in the kingdom of Persia named Mordecai. He does not seem to be a very important person in many respects, but he had a niece named Esther that he loved very much and that he was the caregiver for. There's parts of this story that have always bothered me a little bit, and it is precisely at this point that I'm bothered. Mordecai was a Jew, and as far as we know, faithful to the ideas of Judaism. But when the vacancy for the queen opened up, Mordecai insisted that his niece Esther contend for that position. I've always thought that was strange for Mordecai to do, because he knew what kind of environment and what kind of what Esther would have to do if she became queen. But nonetheless, he did. And Esther stole the hearts of those who were preparing the candidates to be queen. And she befriended the man who could tell her what the king liked or didn't like. And there would be a series of visits by each of these young ladies to the king before a selection would be made. I just cannot imagine putting someone you loved in that situation, but that's what happened. Esther got the king's servant to tell her what perfume he liked and all the other things that the king liked in order to win that position. Sort of the chief of staff for that king was a man named Haman. Haman was very self-important, as well as being important in the kingdom of Persia. Haman had a very strong hatred of the Jews, and particularly he had a strong hatred of Mordecai. And the reason for that is simple, but it shows you how our egos can become so inflated. Mordecai was a big man in the government. And as practice, whenever he walked down the street or passed by a street where people were, the people bowed down to him and showed him that kind of respect. All went well until some of Haman's friends pointed out that there was one man who never would bow down. And he discovered that was Mordecai. The Jews did not believe in bowing down to other men. And so, like I say, he was a very faithful Jew in many respects, but in others, I wonder about him. Haman convinced the king of Persia that the Jews were an unruly group of people and therefore were dangerous to his empire. Now, every king is very vulnerable in their feelings when it comes to people not being obedient. And so the king of Persia signed a law which had been drafted by Haman that on a certain day the Persians could attack all the Jews and kill them and take their goods. Well, when word got out that the kingdom was going to oppress all the Jews, everybody was concerned, including Esther and her uncle. It is at this place in the story that one of the most beautiful statements about providence is made. When Mordecai was telling Esther that she had to go to the king and get that reversed, and she was explaining that if she were to suddenly show up and the king didn't point to her with the golden rod, that she would be killed on the spot, and that she was afraid, Mordecai said, "Who knows but what you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" That's always been a favorite statement made, especially as it indicates the providence of God, who has brought her to this moment of importance in the life of the Jews in Persia. If you read the statement, you notice that it is not a complete statement that this is the reason why Esther was brought to the kingdom, but merely a question that Mordecai said we had to consider. Esther agreed to approach the king about this edict. She did it in a very cunning way. She invited the king and Haman to a dinner that she would prepare for them the next day. And after that splendid dinner, the king wanted to know what Esther had in mind, and she said, "I'll tell you tomorrow, after dinner tomorrow." And so they had another banquet the following night. In the next days, in the party given by Esther, the king's jealousy over Haman's attention to Esther increased. She made an outcry against Haman, and when the king broke into the room, he saw Haman on the floor by the couch pleading with Esther. The king interpreted that circumstance as an attack on the queen and ordered that Haman be killed. Then he wondered about the manner of execution. And one of the striking verses of the book, in the story of Esther, is that someone said to the king, "Well, you know that Haman had built a 50-foot gallows, in which he intended to kill Mordecai." And so the king said, "That sounds good to me." And they hanged Haman on this gallows that had been prepared for Mordecai. Vengeance and retaliation is illustrated in that great book of the Bible. always enjoyed reading and studying the lives of the presidents of the United States, even those that I did not support at the time. One of the most poignant speeches made by President Richard Nixon was his resignation and his speech in the White House to his staff and to his servants and to the friends, just as he resigned and left the presidency. I've watched that several times on television and even got a copy of what he said. You remember that Nixon had an enemies list. This came out in the trial when his John Dean and others talked about it. The enemies list was the informal name of what simply started out as a list of opponents to President Richard Nixon. And in his testimony before Congress, John Dean explained the purpose of the list. This memorandum addresses the matter of how we can maximize the fact of our incumbency in dealing with persons known to be active in their opposition to our administration. Stated a bit more bluntly, how we can use the available federal machinery to destroy our political enemies. That was, and everybody was shocked. Means of tax audits and manipulating grant availability, litigation, and prosecution. These were the things that John Dean said the purpose of that enemies list was for. Let me read to you two sentences out of that speech. This is after President Nixon had announced his resignation, and this is just before he left, having resigned. He said to the group that has assembled, he said, "Never get discouraged. Never be petty. Always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them, and then you destroy yourself." I always thought that was some self-reflection that President Nixon had come to terms with. Retaliation and getting even and revenge, if that eats at us, then we destroy ourselves. That's clearly what the Bible teaches us and what President Nixon discovered in his own life. So it bothers me that we talk about getting even and revenge and putting other people through human misery, and the fact that when another side wins, the other side will get the same treatment. Somehow that must stop. That's not a Christian attitude. It's destructive to every person, and it's destructive to our society. At least those are a couple of things that have been bothering me, and I've been wanting to talk about them, and I have. This morning, we have some visitors with us. A young couple from Angel Fire, New Mexico, which is a favorite place for many people to go, is with us. And we have a young couple with us again. They were here last Sunday. They live here locally. We're glad to have them. And we're going to sing an invitation hymn. And I hope wherever you are singing this and standing, you will rid your mind of any type of hatred of another human being and embrace the love of Christ that has been shown toward you and toward me, and that we are to show toward others. Let's stand to sing. And he bids us all freely drink. Will you come to the fountain free? Will you come? 'Tis for you and me. Thirsty soul, hear the welcome call. 'Tis the fountain open for all. There's a living stream with a crystal gleam from the throne of life. Now it flows while the waters roll. Let the weary soul hear the call that forth freely goes. Will you come to the fountain free? Will you come? 'Tis for you and me. Thirsty soul, hear the welcome call. 'Tis a fountain open for all. There's a rock that's cleft, and no soul is left that may not its pure water share. 'Tis for you and me, and its stream I see. Let us haste joyfully there. Will you come to the fountain free? Will you come? 'Tis for you and me. Thirsty soul, hear the welcome call. 'Tis the fountain open for all.